everybody. Program note, we now post this show every day. It used to be weekly. Now we're doing this daily, and we hold no punches, as I like to say. So look for it. Truth bomb number one. China tells the U.S. if it wants to talk free market talk, it needs to also walk the free market walk. Truth bomb number two. Just how socialist is the U.S. economy? Plenty socialist, if you're wealthy. Truth bomb number three. And speaking of socialists, who set a fire at Bernie Sanders' office? I'm Rick Sanchez, and this is Direct Impact. So the U.S. Treasury Secretary goes to China, and what does Janet Yellen do? She lectures the Chinese government on how to properly run its own economy, hinting that they, the Chinese, don't seem to understand the proper principles of free trade or a free market-based system. Here's just part of Yellen's lecture.
We intend to underscore the need for a shift in policy by China during these talks, building on the over 2 hours I spent on this topic with the Vice Premier last week. This is part of our effort to advocate for American industries and prevent the significant economic disruptions we've seen in the past.
Advocate for American industries. They have to shift their policies. What she's essentially suggesting when she says that China has to change its policy is that China is making too many products that Americans want. And often those products are better products, and they're less expensive than what we make ourselves or import from other Western countries. Now, if that sounds like the state telling businesses what they can or can't produce or should produce or how they should produce it, by golly, you're right. Which is why the Chinese premier, Li Qiang, fired back saying no. He says it's the U.S. that needs to change its policies and be more market-driven. Here's what he actually says. He goes on to say, he says, it is hoped that the United States will abide by the basic norms of market economy, including fair competition and open cooperation, refrain from turning economic and trade issues into political or security issues, and view the issue of production capacity objectively and dialectically from a market-oriented and global perspective. So, wait a minute. Did we just hear China telling the U.S. it needs to be more pro-market? Aren't we here in the U.S. supposed to be the beacon of free market thinking? Aren't those folks in China just a bunch of commies? After all, we hear that kind of talk 24/7 in the Western media. We certainly hear it in Congress and in the Senate and from anybody running for president. Here's Republican Tom Cotton, for example, questioning the CEO of TikTok. Now, this guy, he's got to be a communist, right?
Have you ever been a member of the Chinese Communist Party?
Senator, I'm Singaporean. No.
Have you ever been associated or affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party?
No, Senator. Again, okay. I'm Singaporean.
All right, that's a Republican. Here's a Democrat who is a member of the China Select Committee. I never knew there was a China Select Committee. He is the guy who runs the China Select Committee, which I guess is there to teach China how to be more like us.
What does success look like?
Good to be with you, Chuck. The mission of this committee is twofold. We want to rise above day-to-day politics to chart long-term sound strategy for competition with the Chinese Communist Party.
There it is, the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party. You hear that all the time. Strong words, threatening, right? In other words, they're communists. They're not God-fearing. They're not market-driven. They're not freedom-loving, like us. In fact, heaven forbid that we should ever become anything like them, right?
We renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
And there it is. Yay! Never! That is President Donald Trump during a State of the Union speech, delivering the cheap and easy line guaranteed to get a standing ovation. Unfortunately, for people like him, it's too late. You see, for the wealthy in America, there's plenty of socialism, and they get to reap all the benefits of it. But if you're just a working stiff, a guy trying to feed your family, then you, my friend, you get capitalism and lots of it. Let me take you through it by giving you some examples of what happens to that person. If you're a working dude or a working woman, and you can't pay your bills or pay a loan because you got sick or had a bad month in America, the bank comes after you. And they can sometimes even take your house. And if you just for missing a couple of payments, for example, maybe a couple $1,000, you're done. I mean, you're in a bad way. You could end up on the street. But now, you know what happens when that same bank that just put you on the street fails in the United States? The government steps in and says, don't worry, we got you covered. After the 2008 meltdown, where banks got greedy, fat, stupid, and screwed up the entire system, what happened? Well, here's what happened. The U.S. government took your money, if you're a taxpayer in the United States, they took your money that you pay in taxes, and they gave it to them because they're too big and they're too important. Not like you. You're not that big. You're not that important. They are. Now, wouldn't you call that corporate welfare? Can you say that when the government gives corporations money to run their businesses, that is by definition socialism? With a capital S, perhaps. That's what we're told that China does, right? But then, what would we call this? U.S. banks get $83 billion a year in subsidies because they're too big to fail and too important and are backed by the federal government. That means no matter how bad they screw up, no matter what they do, we are going to take care of them. You see, China? That's the way it's done. China, wait, isn't that what we say they do? I'm confused. So just to be clear, the guys who run the banks, they get millions of dollars. The upper management even get a bonus pool of $34 billion a year. You want to know how much a bank teller makes on average in the United States? $15 an hour. You see, that bank teller, he gets the benefits of capitalism. Now let's talk about cars. When the management of General Motors was on the brink of letting their company go under, the U.S. government stepped right up and said, don't you worry. You know, don't worry, be happy. We make sure that, and they did. They made sure that General Motors and its owners didn't suffer. They gave him $600 million in bailout money and then another $500 million in tax breaks. Oh, and the CEO who was in charge, who kind of did a horrible job. I mean, she screwed up the company, right? Or it got screwed up while she was in charge. She got a $22 million severance package. Here's $22 million. Thank you very much. Go home. You're fired. My God. And what about GM workers, you ask? Oh, the workers. That's right. 14,000 of them were laid off. Let go. What was that again, Mr. President?
We renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
Now let's talk about farm subsidies. You've probably heard of those. Few companies in the world are blessed with more of the benefits of socialism than the agricultural industries that are made up by companies like Monsanto and so many others. And they never have to worry about beating the competition and making sure that people buy their products. Never. It's guaranteed. They're guaranteed to succeed because the U.S. government takes care of that for them. So I checked, and here's what I found. Over the past 5 years, if you pay taxes in the United States of America, right, they take your money because it was given, according to the research we did, they take money that you paid in taxes and they give it to giant agribusiness corporations as a subsidy to make sure that they can succeed. So how much do you think you gave over the past 5 years? $478 billion that you paid in taxes, because apparently they too, these agribusiness corporations, they too are too big to fail. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? All that talk about socialism and communism and how do we need to make sure we're never like them, those Chinese, by golly. Joining us now, Saurabh Gupta, senior Asia-Pacific relations policy expert at the Institute of China-American Studies, with more than two decades of experience right here in Washington, D.C., studying this type of thing. I don't know where to start, but, you know, to hear Yellen yesterday or whenever the hell she said these things that, oh, China, you need to be more like us. You've got to change your ways, by golly. We can show you the promised land. We're the ones who know how to be free market, pro-market, et cetera. And you say what to Ms. Yellen? Mr. Gupta?
Good to be with you, Rick, first of all. What I would tell Mrs. Yellen is that go to China and you will see free market capitalism really taking shape in that country. And that is something which can be learned from. China as a country, in terms of its market, does not pick winners or protect incumbents. It has very low entry barriers and makes firms compete ruthlessly. Where the Chinese state does step in is provide infrastructure and in certain new industries, as we see in solar, electric vehicles, it helps create markets at scale. But once it does help create that market at scale, it makes them fight like cats and dogs to compete, survive, and to prosper. And that's why we have Chinese companies today and in other sectors also prospering, not just at home, but internationally. That is what what capitalism is about. It is really having low entry barriers and making the best succeed through a process of grinding competition. And you will see that happen in China.
So what do you say to all these U.S. politicians, Republicans are most noteworthy for doing this because I think they want to somehow say that their competition, the Democrats, or Joe Biden, for example, is really a Chinese communist or he's akin to Chinese communist. We keep hearing, and by the way, they're not the only ones. We hear it from Democrats as well, to be fair. But we keep hearing that word, oh, those communists, those communists, those communists. It's like the buzzword. What do you think, given what you just said to me, when you hear that?
What I think is at this point of time, they're still trying to create a differentiation. You know, like the usual differentiation the U.S. government always creates. We are always for the people of the country, but not for that regime of the country. Mm-hmm. The way policy plays out most times is it's directed against the people of that country. And in this case, they want to say, we're not against the Chinese people, but we're against the Chinese Communist Party. And considering it's communism is a dirty word, that's why you have everything. Even the House Select Committee is called now the House Select Committee on China. It's on the Chinese Communist Party and hoping to, smear them, whatever. Let them, at the end of the day, you can call them whatever you want to call them. But I think there are a lot of practices that are worth learning from what they are doing at this point of time. In many ways, China is what 100 years back or 75, 100 years back is what the United States was. Immense capabilities, immense entrepreneurialism, and immense competition. Of course, that needs to be placed within a regulated framework. Otherwise, you have things like the Great Depression, et cetera, et cetera. But that's what China is today. It is a competitive marketplace in which people strive to succeed.
Are they communists?
The Communist Party claims to be communist. President Xi, he goes on these big dialectical lectures about what communism is. But to be frank, when he talks about communism or whatever, socialism with communist characteristics, you know, for me, I find that to be I'm going to come out of left field out here. A very Clintonian phrase, you know, Bill Clinton was, all good things happened because of me, all the bad things someone else did. I was not in no way involved. Also, socialism with Chinese characteristics, all that is good about China and works in China is because of the party and because of socialism. All the things which might be not working that well on the human rights front, that's really not part of what we want. That's not what we did. And so for me, I see communism, the way it's practiced in China, to a great deal also, at least from a narrative standpoint, from this dialectical standpoint, is just a lot of opportunism, frankly.
So you can call it what you want. It's just a word. For example, as I just showed in my script, we say we're all free market, the leaders of the world, the beacon of light in the world when it comes to a free market democracy. And yet when I really got in there and broke it down, we're not that much of a free market democracy. In fact, we have the government essentially giving an upper hand to its cronyish friends in separate industries. And we may be doing that, as you say, more than China does. Yet we're capitalists and they're communist. Maybe we should just get away from the labels altogether.
I think you should get away from the labels. And I think the best example of what you said is what was also the topic of discussion in Secretary Yellen's trip, which was on electric vehicles. As I said, the Chinese side makes investments to create markets at scale. It provides initial industrial subsidies. It's fairly easygoing on the subsidy tap at the early stages. It has many players in the marketplace. It makes them compete fiercely. It does not pick winners or protect incumbents. And from this process of, through the process of market discipline, we really have real contestants. And what the Chinese government then does is gradually shut off the subsidy tap to the weaker players. The weaker guys will get no money, and the weaker guys are just left out, need to exit the marketplace.
You know, it's funny you said that about the EVs, and pardon me for interrupting, but I remember a time when we first started relations with China, and Nixon made the trip and everything, and suddenly we realized, oh my God, we can get all these cool things made there, and their workers, we don't have to pay them all that much, and it'll all just be quick and easy, quick, cheap products, and we'll flood Walmarts with them. Now they have become so much more sophisticated and they want to make electric cars. And suddenly, dealing with China or having Chinese products doesn't seem like such a good idea all of a sudden. Now, there's almost some justice in that. And that's kind of what I want to talk about when we come back. All right. So we're talking to Professor Gupta. It's such a pleasure to be able to get a different perspective on something like this. We're going to stay on this topic and be right back to discuss that. The EV market. The Chinese say, hey, we can make EV cars cheaper. The U.S. says, no, we don't want them. Why not? If it's good for American consumers, we'll be right back.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted. Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
And we're joined by Professor Saurabh Gupta. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks for being with us. He is a senior Asia-Pacific relations policy expert at the Institute for China-American Studies, and we thank him for joining us and sharing his wisdom with us. Tell me if this sounds as curious to you as it does to me. It seems like everything was hunky-dory when China was making tons of products and providing them for the American consumer so we could have some pretty cheap goods that we would otherwise have to pay a lot of money for. It's like having Mexican workers in the United States doing work cheaply. But eventually, that goes the other way. And what happens now is, when they were making toys and clothing, it was fine. But now, all of a sudden, they're making phones, computer chips. And now, they think they can make EV cars, electric cars, as good or better, and perhaps even less expensive than the ones that are made here in the United States and made by Tesla, et cetera, et cetera. So now, all of a sudden, I'm seeing there's this resistance, this pushback. How dare you make those products? Those are reserved for us countries like ours. Something seems askew in that argument. Am I reading it wrong?
You are framing it exactly the way the Americans are, the American politicians, particularly in the Beltway, are framing the argument that these are sectors which are where you should not be entering. You stick to do the things which you used to do and make our lives more efficient. But when we come to higher value added products, I stay out of it. That's not where you belong. But I mean, that's not an argument you can make to anybody. Anybody and everybody, whether it's a Rwandan or a Chinese or a Brazilian, has the right to produce an electric vehicle if they produce the most efficient electric vehicle in the world. And that's where they've gone to. And this has come out of sheer entrepreneurialism. I mean, a lot of this is they needed to play catch up. So they had really dedicated folks and entrepreneurs who said, we need to do catch up. Let's try to do it a little differently. Government aided the process initially. And now we have, I mean, think also about this, you know, they then invited the Teslas in at that point of time in the late 2010s, mm-hmm. because they really wanted to benchmark their rising competitors with the best competitor in the market. And they said, now go compete with Tesla and try to do the best. And this is exactly the reason the EV market will fail in the US, because the US is keeping out the best and the most efficient competitor. The US will have its own market, and it'll have the GMs will have their great market share at home with some of the allied friends like Kia and Hyundai, et cetera, et cetera. But you will never break into the international marketplace. What the Inflation Reduction Act, EV tax credits will do is not create manufacturing competitiveness. It'll create manufacturing employment up to a point in the short and medium term. But it will not create competitiveness, which is the basis of long-term employment.
And the Chinese have been very good at this, at television sets, telephones, obviously cell phones, computer chips. My gosh, we thought we owned that industry and nobody could touch us. And now it appears part of the reason we hate China, or are supposed to hate China, is because they've gotten really good at some of that stuff, especially the chips.
Mm-hmm. They have. And, you know, there is a place in domestic and international policymaking for industrial policy. It does sound very socialist, state-centric. There is a space for industrial policy, but industrial policy does not mean just aimlessly throwing money, throwing subsidies, and hoping great things will happen thereafter. You have to be intelligent about the process, and there needs to be foresight about the process. And the whole purpose of industrial policy is to then facilitate market competition. And that's why I keep repeating, not to pick winners or to protect incumbents.
Before we go, we're down to like a minute and a half, and I have two more questions and a story left for you. But first of all, give me a yes and no. They only succeed and are really good at that stuff is because they cheat and steal our ideas. True or false?
a complete false. The EVs are, I mean, they have so many new innovations in the EVs. You just need to be in one of them. I mean, completely false argument. It's not about stealing.
Finally, one final note. I thought it would be fitting to mention this story today before we close. Senator Bernie Sanders, a man who knows a thing or two about socialism, had somebody attack his office by setting it on fire. Police say a person named Shant Shogamonian got into Sanders' building and went up to the third floor, where he is seen spraying some kind of liquid on the door and then setting it on fire. The man is under arrest. It's not known why he did it. But we do know that just last week, Senator Sanders publicly called out Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, urging him to stop killing innocents. He also suggested that the U.S. should give Israel not a penny more. Nope. Still, we don't know what caused. Any comment? What do you think of that? I know you're not our Bernie Sanders expert, but isn't that weird?
My main fear out here is, like, things are spilling out beyond normal politics. I mean, politics, violence is becoming part of the language of politics here, and that's becoming very dangerous. And I think much worse things can happen in a fairly traumatic way. I mean, a candidate being assassinated or those sort of things. You just don't want to go there, and these things need to be nipped in the bud. I think there's no tolerance for this sort of nonsense.
Saurabh Gupta, it's always a pleasure having you on. Thank you for joining me, my friend. Before we go, I want to remind you of our mission. Simple, really. What we do here is we de-silo the world, or at least try to. You know, we got to stop living in these little boxes where we only believe what we believe and what our friends believe. Truths don't live in boxes, and neither should we. We don't. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll be looking for you again right here on Direct Impact.